Micah Clarke by Arthur Conan Doyle. Dramatized in 5 parts by Constance Cox. With Martin Reed as Micah, Patrick Troughton as Decimus Saxon, James Bryce as Reuben Lockerbie, and featuring Simon Ward as the Duke of Monmouth. Micah Clarke, Part 2, The Perilous Journey.
As I drew my sword to await our terrible pursuers, it seems a mere curious irony that I, armed and equipped to fight for Monmouth in the great Protestant cause, should perhaps meet my death before I could strike a blow for him. In the shadow of the rock, Reuben and I could hear the bloodhounds approaching. Then suddenly, a great tawny brute, its black muzzle to the earth, sprang into the moonlight between the rocks, and without pausing, pursued its course onwards with never a glance to right or left. Close behind it came a second, and like the first, it took no notice of us, but bounded along on the trail left by Decimus Saxon.
Why did you shoot?
They were passing us.
Two would have been too much for Saxon. Follow them up.
Did you kill that brute, do you think?
I hope to God I did. Can you hear anything of the soldiers?
No, not a sound.
They've given up the chase then, and loosed the dogs as a last resort. Saxon took this way. We must push on if we're to help him. He may, of course, have decided to make a run for it.
No horse could outstrip those dogs. They must run him to earth, and he knows it. Hello. What have we here? It's a dog you fired at, Micah. You got him.
Then that's one of them disposed of. We've only got one left to deal with now. Come on.
Pray God it's not got him down. It sounded as though it came from that way.
Bursting through a thick belt of scrub and gorse, we came upon a circular clearing, brightly illuminated by the silvery moonshine. In the center of this rose a giant stone, one of those high, dark columns which are found all over the plain, and especially in the parts round Stonehenge. On top of this ancient stone, cross-legged and motionless, like some strange carved idol, sat Decimus Saxon, puffing sedately at his long pipe. Beneath him, a great bloodhound was rearing in its frenzy to reach the impassive figure perched above.
Saxon!
Look, your friend!
Reuben's terrified steed reared, and he rolled off into the very jaws of the hound.
Bravely shot, friend Micah. A bullseye.
Are you hurt, Reuben?
No, I'm only winded. I owe you my life for that, Micah. I hope I may live to do as much for you.
And I owe you both one. I pay my debts, too, for good or evil.
Can you get down? Or do you need help?
Easier down than up. I sprang up here from Chloe's back. Up. No wonder they stuck to my track. I not only left my handkerchief behind, but my spare girth as well. That put them on Chloe's scent as well as mine.
Where is your horse?
Chloe had to look out for herself. I found the brute gaining on me, you see, so as we passed this handy stone, I leapt for it. Even then, I had to tear my heel out of its mouth.
What do you propose to do now, Master Saxon?
I recover my mare if I can, though on this vast moor should be difficult to find.
And my horse must rest.
Rest we dare not, unless under cover. There's none in this place.
Hold a moment.
What are you staring at?
Over there, to the right.
Well?
Don't you see a glimmer of light?
Oh, will-o'-the-wisp.
No, it burns steady and clear.
It may be a dwelling.
Where there's light, there's life. Let's make for it and see what chance of shelter we may find there.
Picking our way across the moor, we directed our course for the light that twinkled in the distance. As we advanced, we hazarded 1,000 conjectures as to whence it could come. The roadway was miles behind us, and no one save those driven by necessity would ever find themselves in that desolate region. As we approached, we saw that the light did indeed come from a small cottage, built into a hollow, so as to be invisible, save from the direction from which we approached. And to our astonishment, Saxon's horse stood peacefully grazing in front of this humble dwelling.
Sorry. My luck holds, comrades. I'm not so sure about the safety of this place.
He's right. That light has changed to red. And there's a most abominable smell in the air.
Chemicals of some sort, I'd say.
Oh.
We've come upon something mighty strange.
And should we press on further, do you think?
No. We need rest and shelter. Only an infidel would refuse to give it to us.
That's what we'd like to find. But have it your way. Knock at the door. Something's being locked away inside. That makes me curious. Knock again.
Who is it?
Three weary travelers who ask the courtesy of your roof.
There's little shelter here, gentlemen, and less provision. Amesbury's but 6 miles further. There you'll find what's needful for man and beast.
One of our horses is completely foundered. We could no more make for Amesbury than the lowlands. We're peaceful men. Why give us such a scurvy reception?
We ask for nothing but shelter, sir.
By the strong light which shone out behind him, we could see that the owner of the cottage was a man of venerable aspect, with snow-white hair and a long, flowing beard. His upright bearing, suggestive of a soldier, and his rich costume of black velvet were strangely at variance with the humble nature of his dwelling place.
Ah, two of you unused to war, and the other an old soldier. You've been pursued, I see.
How did you know that, then?
I've served in my time, friend. I can tell when horses have been spurred to the utmost. Your story, however, can keep. Every true soldier thinks first of his horse. So tether them by the grass and fetch water from the well. Then, gentlemen, you're free to enter. Well is over there.
The strange dwelling which we presently entered had been dug into the side of the little hill against which it had been built, so as to form a long, narrow chamber. The ends of this room were wrapped in shadow, but in the centre was a bright glare from a brazier full of coals, over which a brass pipkin was suspended. A long wooden table was covered with curved glass flasks, basins, tubings and other instruments, while upon a shelf, various coloured liquids and powders were arranged.
You behold in me, gentlemen, the last of an ancient family. I am Sir Jacob Clancing of Snellaby Hall.
Snellaby it should be, Micah.
I pray you be seated. Lay aside your breastplates and headpieces. Remove your boots.
Thank you.
I've but to complete a small experiment which will brook no delay.
Our host approached the evil-smelling pipkin, and dipping a ladle into the compound, scooped up a thick yellow fluid. Then, taking a handful of whitish powder, he threw it into the mixture, which instantly began to froth over into the fire, causing the flames to assume an unearthly greenish hue. This done, Sir Jacob pushed aside all the bottles and turned to us with a smiling face.
No! Let's see what my poor larder can furnish. Meanwhile, this odour may be offensive to your untrained nostrils, so we shall away with it. Thus.
The smell's gone.
How did you do that?
A few grains of balsamic resin, young man.
What?
Known to all chemists. I would I had better fare to offer you, but at least I have trout from a nearby stream, and a venison pasty from deer that sometimes wander by. Oh, I fancy, too, that I can lay my hands upon a bottle or two of old wine.
We shall feast upon this like princes, sir. Thank you.
Then fall to, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
There we are. You are bound for Monmouth's camp, I fancy.
We're bound for the west.
I say no more.
Oh, you need not fear I shall betray you, even if it were in my power. What chance do you think the Duke has against the King's forces?
About as much chance as a farmyard fowl against a spurred gamecock, if he relies on those he has about him. But he believes that England's like a powder magazine, and hopes to be the spark that sets it alight.
The King has very great resources. Where is Monmouth to get his trained soldiers?
There's the militia.
And there's many of the old parliamentarians who aren't too far gone to strike a blow for their belief. All that's needed is to get half a dozen broad-brimmed, snuffle-nosed preachers into a camp, and the whole Presbyterian tribe will swarm round them like flies on a honeypot. No recruiting sergeant will ever raise such an army as a canting preacher.
You sound like a soldier of experience. Why are you throwing the weight of your sword and your skill into the weaker scale?
For the ready reason that it is the weaker scale. It's nothing to me whether James Stuart or James Walters sits on the throne. But the court and army of the king are already made up, so I've nothing to gain there.
Excellent.
Monmouth, on the other hand, has to find courtiers and soldiers. Therefore, it may well happen, he'll be glad of my services and reward them with honourable preferment.
Your logic is sound, but you've omitted the very great risk you run of losing your head if the Duke is defeated.
One can't throw a dice without putting a stake on the board.
And you, young sir, what caused you to take a hand in this dangerous game?
I come around head stock. My folk have always fought for the liberty of the people and the humbling of tyranny. I come in place of my father.
And you, sir?
I come to see something of the world, to be with my friend and companion here.
And I have stronger reasons than any of you for appearing in arms against any man who bears the name of Stuart.
You, sir?
But for my mission here, I might well be tempted to go westward with you. I did not always live in a hovel, gentlemen. Well, more wine, good sirs. That's it. Here's a toast for you. Perdition to all faithless princes.
Aye, perdition.
What happened to you, sir?
What happened to me? What did not? When troubles came upon the first Charles, I stood by him like a brother. Everything I had was poured into the cause, from gold and silver to farms and oak trees. In the end, it was even my own house. After the final ruin of Worcester, I was forced to flee to the lowlands with nothing save my sword and a few broad pieces in my pocket.
But the throne was regained by Charles II. Surely then your services were recognized?
Recognized? Oh, young man, you little know the way of princes. For weeks I hung about the court. I and other poor cavaliers like myself, watching the royal brothers squandering upon their gaming and their royal harlots sums which would have restored to us all we had lost. In desperation, I took myself to a levee. Was duly presented to the king. I explained to him the state to which I'd been reduced in his cause, and his manner chilled to me at once. Everyone is asking me for money in places, he said. However, I'll see what can be done for you.
But he did nothing?
Nothing. Finally, I received another message from him. It was that unless I could dress more in the mode, he could dispense with my attendance at court. That, gentleman, was his answer to the old, broken soldier who had sacrificed health, wealth, position, everything in the service of his father.
It was shameful, sir.
Can you wonder, then, that I cursed the whole Stuart race, false-hearted, lecherous, and cruel?
All the same, friend. I fancy you've found another way back to fortune.
That's as maybe. Ah, but our wine is finished, and your youngest companion is nodding in his chair. There are blankets and rugs. They're only a soldier's couch, but you may sleep on worse before you put Monmouth on the throne.
We're more than grateful, sir.
I myself sleep in an inner chamber, hollowed out of the hill. I bid you good night, gentlemen.
Good night, sir.
Good night, sir.
Reuben's asleep already. I'll throw this blanket over him. Which corner of the room do you want?
Oh, any place will do for me. Master Clark, here.
What is it?
Do you see that iron-bound chest in the alcove? I'll wager it's two-thirds full of gold of that old fellow's manufacture.
Why should you think that?
When we knocked at the door, there was a scuttling about inside and the turning of a lock. I looked through a chink in the wall and saw a dull yellow gleam from that chest that could only come from gold. Let's see if it indeed be locked.
Saxon, the man has been good to us. Would you repay his hospitality by robbing him?
Why not? He can make more as easily as your mother can make apple dumplings.
If you touch that chest, I'll lay you on your back and tell our host what manner of man you are.
It seems to me we shall come as badly out of this war as he did out of his. You refuse all chance of plunder.
I fight for the right, not for booty. Go to sleep. And I warn you, if you stir, I shall know it.
We were up betimes, and after breakfast we looked to our horses. As we prepared for our departure, a host came out carrying some armour and beckoned Reuben.
Young man!
Yes, sir?
You must not go unprotected against the enemy when your comrades are clad in steel. Now, this breastplate and headpiece should fit you.
Oh, they're magnificent, sir. My heart is thanks.
Now, let me help you with the breastplate. Now, it goes so. That's it. Both are steel, so a bullet would glance from them.
Oh.
Now, the headpiece.
Oh.
It couldn't fit you better. You're now a cavalier whom Monmouth will be proud to see ride beneath his banner.
Oh, I'm always minded to ride back to Avon to show them what a stout man-at-arms I've become. I'm truly beholden to you, sir.
And to you, young man, I give this book. I noticed you cast a wistful eye at my bookshelves last night.
Plutarch's Lives. I've long wished for it.
Shape your own life by the example of the giant men whose deeds are recorded in it, and you cannot go wrong.
Thank you, Sir Jacob.
Also, you'll find in your saddlebag a small but weighty packet which I ask you to hand over to Monmouth on the day of your arrival at his camp.
It shall be done, sir.
For you, my old campaigner.
Sir.
Here is a slug of virgin gold, which may fashion into a pin or some such ornament. You may wear it with a quiet conscience, for it's fairly given to you, not filched from your host while he slept. Now, be on your way. Follow the sheep track until you come to a broken path which makes for the west. This path will lead you soon to Mere, and then to Bruton on the Somerset border. Fare you well.
Farewell.
Thank you, Sir Jake.
For many miles we rode across the great dun-coloured plain, avoiding the king's troops whom we saw on the highway. At length we reached Bruton, and of all the recollections I retain of that place, none is so pleasing as that of the buxom landlady's face, and the steaming dishes she placed before us in her own private room.
I hope, gentlemen, you'll find this to your satisfaction.
Yes.
Please to give me a call if there's anything else you require.
I fancy we owe you a favour, mistress.
Oh?
You've given up your room to us, so won't you sit down and share our meal?
Oh, you do me too much honour, sir. It's not for me to sit down with gentlefolk like yourself.
Then you shall drink a glass of wine with us. Beauty such as yours, madam, has a claim. Which persons of quality, and above all, gentlemen of the sword, are the first to acknowledge.
Then, here's to you, sir. And to you, young gentleman.
No.
May there be a speedy end to the insurrection.
Amen to that.
Coupled with your very good health, mistress.
Well, you're soldiers of the king, I take it, gentlemen.
We're bound for the west, certainly, to fight for the right.
They tell me the rebels are as many as 7,000, and they swear to give no quarter. How any gentleman can take to such bloody work when he might have a clean, honourable occupation such as innkeeping or the like is more than my poor mind can understand.
But this business has surely increased your trade, mistress. You have a snug house and a steady income.
True. Oh, would that my poor Peter had lived to share it with me. He was a good man. Even though he did at last become as broad and thick as one of his own beer barrels. Still, if a woman were always to wait until her own fancy came her way, there'd be more maids than mothers in the land.
How runs your own fancy, mistress?
Not in the direction of fat, young man.
Jeez, it's you there, Reuben.
I'd have a man with a knowledge of the world and ripe experience. I'd like him to be tall and of sinewy build. A good talker, so he could help to entertain the gentlefolk when they crack a flagon of wine. And of business habits, too, for this is a busy house, and 200 good pounds a year would pass through his fingers. Yes, if Jane Hobson's to be led to the altar again, it must be by such a man as this. But I must go, gentlemen. Here's more company coming. Thank the Lord.
By heaven, Saxon. She described you to the very life.
Body of me. I've half a mind to marry the widow. Let Monmouth carve out his own future.
So much for loyalty.
Loyalty be hanged. A man must look after himself. 200 pounds a year aren't to be picked off the roadside every morning. What's going on?
Someone's picking your ripe fruit already by the sound of it.
The devil he is.
No quarrelling, Saxon. She's not yours yet.
Forgive me, gentlemen, but this young nobleman would be glad to drink his wine with you if you've no objection. All the other rooms are filled with the townsfolk and peasantry.
Allow me, ma'am, to be my own, Asher. Sir Gervas Jerram, gentlemen, Knight Banneret of the County of Surrey, and your very humble
sir. Welcome, sir. You have before you Don Decimo Saxon of the Spanish nobility, together with Sir Micah Clark and Sir Reuben Lockerbie, both of His Majesty's County of Hampshire.
Proud and glad to meet you, gentlemen. But what's this on the table? Alicante? Oh, fly. Let's have some good sack and plenty of it. Fly, my sweetest. My throat is like leather. We thought I drank deep last night. Plainly, I didn't drink enough. For I was as dry as a concordance when I awoke. You've no objection, gentlemen, if I attempt to amend my toilette.
None in the world, sir.
Saxon sat at table, looking at the stranger out of his half-closed eyes, so that I feared we should have another such brawl as occurred at Salisbury. Our new companion was young, no more than 26, his face thin and aristocratic, with a gay, careless expression. His clothes were in the height of fashion, but they bore evidence of having seen better days, and his toe was pushing its way through the end of one of his long riding boots. While we were noting these peculiarities, he was reclining upon Dame Hobson's taffeta-covered settee, calmly dressing his wig, with a delicate ivory comb he'd taken from a satin bag that hung upon his sword belt.
Lord preserve us from these country inns! What with the want of mirrors, jasmine water, and other necessaries, blister me if one hasn't to do one's toilet in the common room.
When you come to my age, young sir, you may know better than to decry a comfortable common hostel.
Very like, sir, very like. But until that time, I prefer not to behave like a gentleman. Here comes the sack. Pour it out, my pretty he.
Oh, no, sir.
These gentlemen are to do me the honor of drinking with me. A pinch of snuff, sir. You may well look at the box. A pretty little thing from a certain lady of title who shall be nameless. Though, if I were to say that her title begins with a D and her name with a C, well, a gentleman of the court might hazard a guess.
Mistress Harbison, a private word with you.
Oh, why, to be sure, sir. So where that's not crowded.
Anywhere but here.
Sink me. I've frightened your comrade away. Or is it possible he's pursuing the plump widow? I thought he looked in no very good temper when I kissed her at the door. It is a courtesy I seldom refuse to anything which wears a petticoat. Are you riding to the wars, gentlemen? You seem much armed and accoutred.
We are bound certainly for the west.
Ah, in what capacity? A king or pretender? For myself, I'd as soon ride with the clown as the crown, with all due respect to your own princes.
For God's sake, sir. Don't you know you risk your liberty, perhaps your life, in saying what you just said?
I don't care the rind of rotten orange for life or liberty either. It'd be a new sensation for me to bandy words with some clodhopper country justice and be consigned to a dungeon like the hero in a play.
With racks and pincers for a prologue.
Oh, anything for a change. But you've not answered my question.
I can hardly be as frank as you, sir. Hasty confidences are apt to lead to repentance.
A Daniel come to judgment. I'll warrant you're 5 years younger than me, yet you talk like the seven wise men of Greece. Will you take me as your valet?
As a what?
Valet. Groom de chambre, a body servant, what you will. I need a place, young gentleman.
You'd be my valet?
Why not? I've been waited on so long, it's my turn to wait now. And I wouldn't wish a more likely master. Do you want a list of my accomplishments? I can dance, fence, ride, sing, play the best game of picquet in London, brew a bowl of punch and broil a deviled fowl. It's not much, but I can do it well.
You're speaking in jest, of course.
Well, not a whit. To such base uses are we come, as Shakespeare says. Sir Jervis Jerome, knight banneret, sole owner of Beecham Ford Park, with a rent roll of 4,000 a year, is up for sale and will be knocked down to the bidder who pleases him best.
Are you saying you've lost it all, Sir Jervis?
Not lost, young friend. Ran through it, as the saying is. I've a guinea or two in my purse and my rings, my gold snuff box. But I have, too, in this bag, the means of preserving that elegance of person which made me as well-groomed a man as ever set foot in St. James's Park. What more could a man wish for, hmm?
It would be absurd, Sir Jervis, for me to take you as my valet.
Oh, you rate yourself too low, Master Clark.
But if you care to attach yourself to our party, I see no objection. Unless Master Saxon demurs.
And on his cue comes the Knight of the Wrathful Countenance.
Our horses are ready. We stay too long as it is.
Saxon, Sir Jervis would like to travel with our party.
With your permission.
We go to fight, sir. It's no work for Coxholm.
Wait. Monmouth is weak in horse. Sir Jervis is a well-appointed cavalier and ready for anything.
To the death, if need be.
Well, the handle to his name may be of use. If you come with us, Sir Jervis, you must be ready to follow without question. Is that agreed?
With all my heart.
Then let's drink to our better acquaintance.
I pledge you all. Here's to a fair fight, and may the best man win.
By the Lord Harry, sir, I trust there's metal in you for all your gay plumage. Give me your hand.
The soldier of fortune's great brown fist enclosed the delicate hand of our new friend. Then, bidding adieu to Dame Hobson, who glanced reproachfully at Saxon, we sprang on our horses and continued our journey. Sir Jervis soon proved himself in a skirmish we had with a troop of the King's Dragoons encountered on the road to Taunton. Reuben and I acquitted ourselves with credit, Sir Jervis with gallantry, and Saxon with such generalship that, aided by some peasants armed with pikes and scythes, we left 9 enemy dead and 14 wounded. As we entered Taunton, we found that Saxon's fame had preceded him, and on the steps of the town hall, the mayor offered him the command of the town's forces, which were awaiting the coming of Monmouth.
'Tis raw material you'll have to lick into soldiership, I fear, Colonel Saxon. But their hearts are great, and they'll lay down their lives for the cause.
How many musketeers have we, Mr. Mayor?
As yet, 45.
Sir Jervis?
Colonel?
I hand over the captaincy of this company to you.
Gad, but I shall insist they powder their heads.
Do as you will with them. Now let the pikemen stand forth.
There are 87, Colonel.
Serviceable number. Lockerbie,
Colonel,
you'll take these men and ride at their head.
Peace, Micah.
They don't fight better than their captain rides. It'll be a new business.
Captain Michael Clark.
Colonel Saxon.
The third company of scythe men I commit to your charge.
Sir.
Now, hark you all, my friends. Whilst I command, this regiment shall be worthy to stand among the best in this great and soul-raising cause. If there is any man among you who fears to serve under a hard discipline, let him stand forth now.
Not one man moves, Colonel.
Look to such arms as you have. We drill at first light in the morning.
Colonel Saxon, I trust you and your officers will take your abode up with me during your stay in this town.
We should be happy to, sir. We've not yet arranged quarters.
Then come with me, gentlemen.
These are my work people and apprentices. Is the food ready, Ruth?
All ready, Grandpa.
This gentleman is my granddaughter, Ruth. These cavaliers, my dear, have come from afar to serve the cause and have done us the honor to accept our hospitality.
Oh, be seated, please, gentlemen.
Oh, thank you, Mistress Ruth. Micah, don't you think that little Mistress Ruth is one of the prettiest girls you ever spied?
Keep your admiration to yourself, Reuben. That young man across the table has seen how you looked at her. He doesn't seem friendly.
Mr. Mayor, when is Monmouth expected?
The king lies less than 10 miles off. We expect him to make his entry into the town within 5 days.
He calls himself king already, does he? As well, perhaps, now to assume the crown, since he may not wear it later.
Right will prevail. Is it not so spoken in a good book?
Oh, hush, John Derrick.
Aye, but right is better enforced by might. And might is what we lack.
The Durin are at the strength of 20 men. Peace, John Derrick. Your zeal outruns your courtesy.
Your enemy's hot-blooded, Reuben.
Aye. Take no offence, Colonel. He's a good young man and an honourable craftsman. Last Lady Day, he aspired to the hand of my granddaughter, but she would have none of him, and I fear he took it badly.
Now, gentlemen, you've had hard travel and hard fighting. Now you must eat and drink heartily, or I will say grace.
Next morning, from cockcrow to sunset, the streets resounded with the commands of poise your muskets and order your muskets as we daily became more soldierly. Late one evening, I was returning to Mayor Timewell's house when suddenly I heard shouting and the clash of swords.
You're not wanted here, Lockerbie!
Micah! Micah! Help me!
For God's sake! Reuben! Why don't you stand and fight, you coward?
Reuben, are you hurt? In the wind, mostly. Thanks to Sir Jacob's breastplate. Look to the girl. Why, Mistress Ruth.
I'm unhurt, Master Clark. Thanks to you, Reuben.
We should go off.
Oh, no, please. Let the matter rest. And say nothing to my grandfather.
It should be told. The man ought to be taken up.
He has greater matters on his mind. It would only distress him. Oh, promise me, please, to say nothing.
If you wish.
Oh, thank you. Oh, dear. I seem to have lost my glove. Oh, no matter. I may find it in the morning. Good night to you both.
Good night, Ruth.
Good night.
Reuben. That man who attacked you. I thought I recognized him.
So did I. A grandfather should be aware of some of his apprentices.
Derek. He's jealous of you, Reuben.
He'd have cause to be if he knew I had this.
That glove? You picked it up?
And wouldn't barter it for all the gold in her grandfather's coffers.
You came to fight, not to fall in love.
Early next day, we learned that Monmouth was approaching the town with his army. Every effort was made to give him a welcome which should be worthy of the most Protestant town in England. Rich velvets, tapestries, and costly brocades fluttered from windows and lined the balconies. Gay flags hung from the roof, and the blue ensign of Monmouth waved from the turret of St. James's Church. Saxon and I sat on our horses at the head of our companies, and as we watched, the van of Monmouth's army began to roll out from the cover of the trees.
Oh,
from here.
But they splendid.
Splendid? Haven't they a general among them? No advance party before the vanguard. No space left between the foreguard and the main battle. Why, if I were a king's officer with a troop of light horse, I could swoop down on them like a kestrel on a brood of young plover and scatter them in a cloud of dust.
Riding into battle yet?
One should always be prepared. Leader, if I mistake not.
As he spoke, a group of gaily dressed cavaliers broke away from the main body and rode straight for the town. Their leader was a tall, slim, elegant young man who sat his horse with the grace of a skilled rider and who was remarkable for the richness of his trappings and the gallantry of his bearing.
Going to meet them.
Your Majesty, you do our town great honor.
You must not kneel to me, good Master Mayor. It's for my enemies to think before me, not my friends. What is that scroll you hold?
An address of welcome and allegiance, Your Majesty, from the loyal citizens of Taunton.
I need no such address. It's written all around me in fairer characters than ever found themselves upon parchment. Your name is Stephen Timewolf, I understand.
The same, Your Majesty.
Too short a name for so trusty a man. I shall make it longer by three letters. Kneel, Master Timewolf. Rise up, Sir Stephen. And may I find many other knights in my dominion as loyal and as worthy. My people, I call you my people, for you have called me your king. I come not to assert my right, but to throw down the usurper and allow the commons of England to appoint a monarch of their choice. It will be a hard fight and a bitter one, but though our numbers are small, our hearts are great. For God is with us. He will help us to build in this England of ours such a temple to the true faith that popery shall never prevail against it.
Monmouth called a council meeting that same evening, and we were summoned to attend.
Pretty company in face. There's not a man here who hasn't been tempted by some bait or other. With Grey, it's a dukedom. With Wade, a woolsack. And that German Bowser by the plunder of Cheapside.
You came into this affair yourself with Holbrook profit.
In return for loyalty. I doubt if some of these men can say as much.
Quiet. The Duke is going to speak.
I must join him.
Colonel Bowser, may I sit by you?
Of course, old comrade. Welcome.
Gentlemen, we are here to consider the conflict which lies before us.
God will defend the right.
I trust he will, Dr. Ferguson, but it's beholden to us to give him such assistance as we can. Colonel Saxon.
Your Majesty.
I'm told you've seen much service abroad. What think you of our army you saw this morning?
It's like so much uncarded wool, Your Majesty. Rough enough at the moment, yet may in time be woven into a noble garment.
There's not much leisure for the weaving. The question is, do we stay here, where our own strength lies, to await the usurper's troops, or do we go forward to meet them? Well, speak, gentlemen.
Well, if nobody else will give an opinion, I will speak for myself, as led by the inward voice. Have we not heard that Argyle is cutting off?
More the pity, Dr. Ferguson.
Aye, and for why, Lord Grey? Because he had no due faith in the workings of the Almighty. Why did he not gird up his loins and march straight onwards towards the wicked town of London, instead of dallying here and biding there? And the same will befall us if we do not march on. We have the men. What should stay us here?
Your Majesty, might I ask, what is our total strength?
I brought 8,000 men with me into the town, my good Colonel Bowser, and 1,500 more have joined me here.
Mm.
As many again were turned away because we could not arm them. Lord Grey, you've heard what Dr. Ferguson has said. What is your advice?
To advance to the east would be fatal.
You are a minister, Dr. Ferguson. I am a soldier. James Stewart is strong in horse, and we have none. We can hold our own amongst hedgerows or in broken country, but what chance will we have in the middle of Salisbury Plain? My humble judgment, sir, unless we heard of some great outbreak elsewhere or some general movement in our favour in London, we would do best to hold our ground and await an attack.
But how long are we to wait for this outbreak which never comes, for this support which he never promised and never provided? Not a nobleman has taken up arms for me save Lord Grey, who was himself an exile. Where are the men who were promised to me from London? Where are the breakings out from Berwick to Portland? Not a man has moved, save only these good peasants. I've been deluded, ensnared, trapped. Trapped by vile agents who've led me into the shambles.
Trust in the Lord, sir!
At this moment, I would rather trust in a strong fighting army. Colonel Bowser, do you agree with my Lord Grey?
Ask Saxon, your Majesty. He and I have fought together in wars abroad. My opinion is seven, same as his.
Colonel Saxon, if you had the casting vote in this, how would you decide? Advance or stand our ground? I'm waiting, Colonel.
As I understand it, Your Majesty, 3,000 of James Stewart's foot, 800 of the Blue Guard, and 2 or 3 Dragoon regiments are making for Salisbury Plain. If we attempt an engagement, we should be scattered like grains of dust.
As I said, sire.
Lack of faith, Your Majesty! Lack of faith!
Peace, Master Ferguson! Let Colonel Saxon go on.
On the other hand, sire, to remain here is equally impossible. Your Majesty's friends would lose all heart. The rustics would drift away to their wives and homes.
He's right, sire. Seen a great army soar away like an icicle in the sunshine.
Well, what then is our alternative?
To keep them, we must employ them. Never let them have an idle minute. Drill them, march them, exercise them, work them, preach to them.
You mean then keep them here, Colonel Saxon?
No, sire. This cannot be done in snug quarters. They must travel. We can't hope to end this business until we get to London.
London,
therefore, must be our goal.
But the troops are waiting us.
There are many ways of reaching London, Lord Grey. Your Majesty, I've heard, has many friends in Bristol and the Midlands.
That is so.
My advice, then, is that we march round in that direction. Should we take Bristol, and I've heard the works are not very strong.
Aye, that's so.
It would give us a very good command of shipping and a rare centre from which to act.
By my faith, Colonel, you make it all as clear as day. If we make ourselves strong in the west and my uncle is threatened with disaffection elsewhere, he will have no chance to hold out against us. To fight us on our own ground, he would have to drain his troops from north, south and east, which is not to be thought of. We may very well march to London by way of Bristol.
One point which might be urged.
Let us hear it, Master Wade. You've been silent hitherto.
We have, as Your Majesty truly says, met with discouragement in the fact that no noblemen and few commoners of repute have declared for us. It would assist our cause if we could bring a duke or two to our standard.
But how? That's the question.
I would recommend, Your Majesty, some form of summons or writ be served upon them, calling them to appear in our camp within a certain date upon pain of high treason.
Oh, there spoke the legal mind. But you've omitted to tell us how the same writ or summons is to be conveyed to the said delinquents.
Such a summons should be sent to the Duke of Beaufort. He is president of Wales. He has 200 horses in his stables. 1,000 men sit down at his tables every day. Moreover, he is Protestant.
Aye.
A special effort should be made to gain him over.
You forget Wade Beaufort is already in arms against us.
As Your Majesty says. But he may be induced to change, sir.
Your counsel is good, Master Wade.
but I fancy your messenger would find himself swinging from one of the badminton oaks if the Duke desired to show his loyalty to James Stewart. Where are we to find a man wary and bold enough for such a mission?
Well, that's true, Lord Grey. Better not to do it at all than do it in a clumsy and a halting fashion.
Sir, it could be accomplished if only one man could be found.
Who is that Goliath at the back who appears to be signalling to us?
One of my captains, Your Majesty, Micah Clark, a man of Hampshire.
You have something to say, Captain Clark?
If it please Your Majesty, have I your permission to speak on two matters?
By all means.
First, sire, I was commissioned by Sir Jacob Clancing to give you this packet.
Clancing? Well, what does it contain?
Well, I do not know, Your Majesty.
A bar of pure gold, by all that's wonderful. Take it, Wade, and add it to the common fund. That little piece of metal will furnish 10 pikemen. Our warmest thanks to Sir Jacob.
There's a scrap of paper here you've not read, sire. Also from Sir Jacob.
Oh, it's a rhyming catch, or a posy of a ring. What, gentlemen, are we to make of this? When my star is in trine, between darkness and shine, Duke Monmouth, beware of the Rhine. Well, what some fool is this?
Your Majesty, I believe Sir Jacob is deeply skilled in the arts of divination.
Oh, he's missed his mark this time, my fair. There's little chance of our fighting out our quarrel on the banks of the Rhine. You had something more to say, Captain Clark?
If you think me worthy enough, sire, I would like to offer myself as your messenger to the Duke of Beaufort. My father bade me spare neither life nor limb in this quarrel. If the council think the Duke may be won over, I'm ready to guarantee that the message shall be delivered to him.
No better herald could be found, sire. The lad has a cool head and a staunch heart.
Then, young sir, we accept your loyal and gallant offer. Be ready and saddle tomorrow at daybreak.
I will, sir.
Now, gentlemen, I dismiss you to your posts. Be diligent and faithful.
Michael, lad, for God's sake, take care. There's real danger in what you've done. The Duke is lieutenant of the county, which means he has the power to hang you if he chooses.
I know it, Saxon.
On the other hand, if you chance to succeed, it may lay the foundations of your fortune and be the means of saving Monmouth. And by the Lord Harry, he needs help enough. I never saw such a rabble as that army of his. A few whiffs of shot and a cavalry charge would scatter them over the country. Have you any messages to leave?
None. Save my love to my mother.
Remember this, lad. Should you fall in any unfair way, I'll not forget His Grace of Beaufort. Any of his gentlemen who come my way shall hang as high as Haman. You'll make for your chamber and have as good a slumber as you may. God go with you.
Having given my orders that Covenant should be saddled and bridled by daybreak, I'd gone to my room and was preparing for a long night's rest when Sir Jervis came in bearing some papers.
What do you most wish for?
News from Havant.
Right.
This is from my father.
Hmm? What says he? Mm. Oh, come, let me just have a glimpse of your respected parent, the Roundhead.
A few lines, then. My dear son, I trust you are bearing yourself as becomes you. In all danger and difficulty, ask help from on high. Mm-hmm. If you are in authority, teach your men to sing psalms as they fall on, as is the good old custom, and strike lustily for truth and conscience.
Yeah, good precepts, you say.
There's a note, too, from my mother. Ah. Micah, dear, remember what I said about your hose, and also the broad linen collars you will find in your bag. Should your feet chafe, rub tallow on the inside of your boots. And when cold or wet, take 10 drops of Daffy's Elixir in a small glass of strong waters. 1,000 kisses, dear heart, from your loving mother.
Ah, a right sensible couple. I now begin to understand your manufacture, Clark. This tells me enough of your home at Havant to make me wish to know more.
I hope one day you will visit me there.
One day, perhaps. Well, out with the light now. We must both be staring at cockcrow. And that's our religion at present. Early Christians.
I woke early and dressed quietly so as not to disturb Jervis, who was still asleep. In Mayor Timewell's parlour, I found myself confronted by a fussy little person.
Ah, Captain Clark, you're already astir.
Who are you? Oh, you're the mayor's clerk, surely.
That's right, Captain. Tetheridge is my name. Sir Stephen, you may recall His Majesty knighted him for his services.
I do, but to the point, Master Tetheridge.
Sir Stephen requested me to come and see if there was anything you required for your journey, feeling, rightly enough, it were better the ordinary servants knew nothing about it.
The news seems to have spread, nonetheless.
Ah, but I'm to be trusted, you see, Captain, being in Sir Stephen's confidence. Let me assist you with your accoutrements. You've not yet put on your breastplate or helmet.
I shan't be wearing them.
But, Captain,
I shall be riding as an ordinary traveller, not as a soldier. Thank you for coming, Master Tetheridge. But tell the mayor there is nothing I need.
Oh, I forgot to tell you, Captain. The Honourable Master Wade is waiting for you.
Master Wade? Bring him in at once.
Certainly, Captain. Master Wade...
Forgive me, sir. I've only just learned you were here.
Pray leave us, Master Tetheridge.
Sir, good fortune go with you, Captain.
Aye.
Now, Captain Clark, as to your journey, you had best make your way round by Neverstowey and the Bristol Channel. We've heard that the enemy's horse blocks the road on the far side of Wells. Here is the packet for the Duke of Beaufort. Guard it well.
I will, sir.
That packet also contains a copy of the deposition of the clergyman at The Hague, who saw Charles II marry Lucy Walters, the mother of His Majesty. I must impress upon you that your mission is of such importance that the success of our whole enterprise may turn upon it. See that you serve the packet only upon the Duke, not through any intermediary, or it may not stand in a court of law.
I give you my word, sir.
Good. That's all then, Captain. The Duke may be at Bristol, but you'd best make for his seat at Badminton. Keep a still tongue and a quick ear. And God be with you.
And so I rode out through Taunton, with its streets still decorated with faded flowers and gay with streamers, upon the most dangerous journey I was ever to take in my life.
That was part two of Micah Clark by Arthur Conan Doyle, dramatized in five parts by Constance Cox, with Martin Reed as Micah, Patrick Troughton as Decimus Saxon, James Bryce as Reuben Lockerbie, and featuring Simon Ward as the Duke of Monmouth. Sir Jacob Clancing was played by Lockwood West, Sir Jervis Jerram by Mark Straker, Dame Hobson by Mia Soterio, Mayor Timewell by William Eagle, His Daughter Ruth by Jenny Funnell, John Derrick by William Hope, Dr. Ferguson by Henry Stamper, Lord Grey by David Sinclair, Captain Bowser by Geoffrey Collins, Master Wade by Steve Hodson, and Master Tetheridge by Stephen Thorne. Micah Clark was directed by David Johnston.